This is Barbara Foster reading about diabetes. Ozempic linked to major weight loss in obesity by Quinn Phillips. A study has found that Ozempic, semaglutide, a drug for type 2 diabetes, may lead to substantial weight loss in obese people, even if they don't have diabetes, potentially offering a new way to help treat obesity. The research, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, was a clinical trial involving 1,961 participants, all of them adults. None of the participants had diabetes, and all of them were obese, with a body mass index, a measure of weight that takes height into account, of 30 or higher. Participants were randomly assigned to take a once-weekly injection of either Ozempic or a placebo, inactive substance. All of the participants also took part in a lifestyle intervention program aimed at losing weight. After 68 weeks of treatment, members of the Ozempic group lost an average of 14.9% of their body weight, a large, clinically important weight reduction. Members of the placebo group, on the other hand, lost an average of only 2.4% of their body weight. As you would expect with these numbers, a larger proportion of people in the Ozempic group lost at least 5% of their body weight, 86%, compared with just 32% in the placebo group. And a larger proportion also lost at least 10% of their body weight, 69% for Ozempic, but only 12% for placebo. These numbers matter because studies have shown that losing just 5% to 10% of your body weight can lead to significant health benefits if you're overweight or obese. Members of the Ozempic group also experienced greater improvement in risk factors for cardiovascular disease, as well as self-reported physical functioning in daily life. The most common side effects of Ozempic were nausea and diarrhea, which tended to be mild to moderate and temporary. But more people in the Ozempic group stopped their treatment because of gastrointestinal issues, 4.5%, compared with 0.8% in the placebo group. This study shows that Ozempic is a strong contender as a standalone treatment for obesity and may soon get regulatory approval for that purpose. This is important because right now there aren't many approved drug treatments for obesity. Of course, people with type 2 diabetes can already be prescribed Ozempic for blood glucose control under current guidelines, and this study shows that for those who are obese, doctors should potentially give Ozempic special consideration as a treatment. It's worth noting that certain groups were underrepresented as participants in the study, including men, black people, and other non-white people. And as noted in a Helio article on the study, over 40% of participants had pre-diabetes or impaired glucose tolerance that doesn't meet the threshold for diabetes. For this reason, it's unclear how effective Ozempic might be in obese people with normal glucose tolerance. Diet with high GI tied to cardiovascular disease by Quinn Phillips. Eating foods with a high glycemic index is linked to a higher rate of major cardiovascular events like heart attacks and strokes, as well as a higher rate of overall death, according to a new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine. A food's glycemic index is a measure of how much it leads to an increase in blood glucose levels on a scale of 0 to 100. Avoiding high glycemic index foods may be especially important for people with diabetes, who typically can't produce enough insulin to adequately lower blood glucose in response to spikes caused by these foods. In the latest study, researchers looked at data from 137,851 participants, ages 35 to 70, who lived on five different continents. They were followed for an average of 9.5 years, during which there were 8,780 deaths and 8,252 major cardiovascular events. The researchers used country-specific food questionnaires to estimate the glycemic index of foods in participants' diet and their overall intake of those foods. Based on the overall glycemic index of their diet, participants were placed in five groups of equal size from the lowest to the highest glycemic index. The researchers found that compared with the lowest glycemic index group, members of the highest glycemic index group were more likely to have a major cardiovascular event or to die. A higher glycemic index diet was also linked to death, specifically from cardiovascular causes. The researchers found similar results when they looked at glycemic load, or the overall impact of foods on glucose levels based on their glycemic index and serving size. This study's results show that consumption of poor quality of carbohydrates is likely to be more adverse than the consumption of most fats in the diet, said study author Dr. Salim Yusuf, a professor of medicine at McMaster University in Canada, in a news release. This calls for a fundamental shift in our thinking of what types of diet are likely to be harmful and what types neutral or beneficial. And now a quiz on dietary fiber by Lisa Cantkier. Fiber is a type of carbohydrate that your body can't digest, and its intake is linked to many health benefits. There are two types of fiber. Soluble fiber dissolves in water and can help lower your glucose levels and LDL, bad cholesterol. Insoluble fiber does not dissolve in water and can help food move through your digestive system, thereby promoting bowel regularity. How much do you know about fiber? Take this quiz to find out. Before changing your diet or considering supplements, consult with your healthcare provider to find out what is safe for you. Number 1. True or false? Children and adults need 10 to 15 grams of fiber daily for good health. The answer is false. According to the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, children and adults actually need at least 20 to 30 grams of fiber per day for good health, but most Americans only get about 15 grams of fiber per day. Number 2. To ensure you get enough fiber, you should do which of the following? A. Increase your intake of whole grains. B. Increase your intake of refined grains. C. Increase your intake of whole and refined grains. D. Decrease your intake of grains. And the answer is A. According to the American Heart Association, whole grains contain the entire grain, the bran, germ, and endosperm, and nothing important is stripped away. On the other hand, refined, processed grains have been milled, ground, which removes the beneficial bran and germ component. This improves their shelf life but strips away important nutrients. Question number 3. A sufficient amount of dietary fiber offers which of the following health benefits? A. A reduced risk of heart disease and stroke. B. Improved blood cholesterol levels. C. A reduced risk of obesity and type 2 diabetes. D. All of the above. The answer is D. A review of research about whole grain intake and diabetes in the journal Nutrients concluded that a higher intake of whole grain is associated with a lower risk of type 2, as well as an improvement of its major risk factors, such as obesity, plasma glucose regulation, postprandial, after meal, hyperinsulinemia, and insulin resistance. The American Heart Association says fiber can help you improve blood cholesterol levels and lower your risk of heart disease, stroke, obesity, and even type 2 diabetes. Question number 4. How does dietary fiber benefit bowel health? A. It helps prevent constipation. B. It helps prevent loose stools. C. It helps prevent constipation and loose stools. D. It helps prevent intestinal gas and bloat. And the answer is 4C. According to the Mayo Clinic, a high-fiber diet normalizes your bowel movements and helps prevent both constipation and loose stools. Fiber increases the size and weight of your stool and softens it. A bulky stool is easier to pass, decreasing your chance of developing constipation. On the other hand, if you have loose, watery stools, fiber can help to make your stool more solid because it absorbs water and adds bulk. A high-fiber diet may increase intestinal gas and bloat, especially if you add too much very quickly, so be sure to increase your fiber consumption gradually. And question number 5. Consuming high amounts of dietary fiber, especially cereal fiber, is related to a reduced risk of developing diabetes, true or false? And the answer is true. A meta-analysis investigating the relationship between dietary fiber and type 2 diabetes found a significant reduction in the relative risk of type 2 diabetes among those consuming the most fiber, with the greatest benefit coming from cereal fibers. There were other health benefits observed for people with type 2 who added beta-glucan, a form of soluble fiber, or psyllium fiber to their diet, including small reductions in fasting blood glucose and A1C, a long-term measure of glucose control. Women with T1D have shorter reproductive window by Quinn Phillips. Women with type 1 diabetes tend to have a shorter span of reproductive years than women without diabetes, according to a small new study published in the journal Menopause. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh looked at a group of 80 women with type 1 diabetes, all of whom were diagnosed as children between 1950 and 1980. Each had reached menopause by the time of the study, and none had received hormone replacement therapy during their menopausal transition. The researchers compared these women with another group of 178 women without diabetes who otherwise fit the same study criteria. Women with diabetes in the study were younger overall and more likely to be white, to have never smoked, and to have a lower body mass index, BMI, a measure of weight that takes height into account, than women without diabetes in the study. The researchers adjusted for these factors when determining the effect of having type 1 diabetes on the length of women's reproductive years. Each woman's span of reproductive years was determined based on self-reporting of when they had their initial menstrual period and when they reached menopause. The researchers found that on average, the span of reproductive years was 2.5 years shorter for women with type 1 diabetes. Women with diabetes had their first menstrual period an average of 0.5 years later than women without diabetes, and reached menopause an average of 2.0 years earlier. While their findings clearly demonstrated a shorter span of reproductive years in women with type 1 diabetes who were diagnosed before beginning menstruation, the researchers noted that their study didn't offer many clues as to why this took place. Further studies are needed to determine modifiable factors that contribute to early menopause to improve reproductive health in women with type 1 diabetes, they wrote. Retina scan results tied to cognitive function in T1D by Quinn Phillips. Finding ways to predict cognitive decline in people with diabetes would be welcome to many, especially if it were followed by interventions that might help people avoid cognitive changes. Unfortunately, predicting this decline isn't always easy, and cognitive exams take considerable time and expense, and can have varying results depending on how a person is feeling that day and other factors that may affect results. But according to a new study, there may be a way to help predict cognitive decline in people with diabetes by administering a test that many people need and receive already, non-invasive retinal imaging scans of the eye. The study, published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, included 129 participants with type 1 diabetes who had the condition for at least 50 years. At a university hospital setting, participants went through a complete cognitive testing regimen, which included measures of psychomotor speed, immediate memory, and delayed memory. Participants also underwent two different kinds of eye scans, optical coherence tomography, OCT, and OCT angiography, OCTA. These tests measured neural retinal layer thicknesses, as well as blood vessel density for both superficial and deep retinal capillary plexus, SCP and DCP. Researchers found that decreased blood vessel density, as measured by both SCP and DCP in the eyes, was associated with worse delayed memory, as well as worse psychomotor speed involving using the dominant hand to complete tasks. Thinning of the retinal outer nuclear layer was associated with worse psychomotor speed in tests involving participants' dominant hand as well as their non-dominant hand. Thinning of the eye's outer plexiform layer, a dense network of neuronal synapses, was associated with delayed memory in cognitive tests. These findings, the researchers wrote, suggest that non-invasive retinal imaging scans, both OCT and OCTA, could be a useful way to screen people with diabetes, especially type 1, for cognitive dysfunction. This screening could then be followed up with a cognitive assessment, and measures to help slow or prevent further cognitive decline could be put in place or ramped up if needed. At first glance, the connection between eye damage due to diabetes and cognitive decline may not seem obvious, but considering how close your eyes are to your brain, it shouldn't be surprising that the two are connected. Diabetes can damage tiny blood vessels in your eyes, leading to retinal damage, diabetic retinopathy, and blood vessel damage could also affect your brain's blood supply, as well as potentially blood vessels in the brain itself. These findings suggest that non-invasive retinal imaging using OCT and OCTA may provide readily accessible, reproducible, and non-invasive surrogate markers to evaluate cognitive dysfunction in people with type 1 diabetes, the researchers conclude. Furthermore, these markers may be relevant across the spectrum of retinopathy severity. Kidney disease often progresses quickly with diabetes, by Quinn Phillips. Chronic kidney disease, CKD, can be detrimental to quality of life in people who develop it, especially if the condition progresses rapidly. Not only does it typically require modifying your diet in ways that might seem strange, but also it can cause deep fatigue, loss of appetite, and, in later stages, requires either regular dialysis treatments or a kidney transplant. So, a new study in the progression of CKD in people with diabetes should raise some alarm bells, since it shows that, in many people, the condition progresses rapidly in the months following their diagnosis. The new research, published in the Clinical Kidney Journal, notes that since CKD is a fairly common complication of type 2 diabetes, the growing number of people with type 2 means that CKD is also expected to rise. The study looked at thousands of newly recognized CKD cases in the United States from January 2008 to September 2018 among people who already had type 2 diabetes. Their disease progression was assessed through two measures of kidney function: estimated glomerular filtration rate, eGFR, and urine albumin creatinine ratio, UACR. Data from 88,766 people was included in the study. Over a median follow-up period of 2 years, the data showed worsening CKD in 10% to 17% of the participants, depending on exactly how it was evaluated. This result was based on about one-third of all participants showing worse numbers for their eGFR or UACR. The researchers concluded that their results showed a relatively high percentage of CKD cases getting worse over a short period of time, perhaps a greater number than most of them had anticipated. This means, they write, it's essential to adopt better steps than we now have to identify which people with type 2 diabetes and CKD are likely to experience rapid progression of their CKD. Brief, frequent exercise breaks can help blood vessels, study, by Joseph Castatis. A main reason exercise is so beneficial for people with diabetes is because they are at higher risk for heart disease and reduced vascular function than people without diabetes. Vascular function is an indication of blood flow, of the diameter and tone of blood vessels, and of the health of a person's arteries. It's no surprise that prolonged sitting is a risk factor in heart disease for everyone, not just people with diabetes. And in these pandemic times, many of us find ourselves sitting more than ever. According to the authors of the new study, because of rapidly advancing technologies in workplaces, transportation, and home entertainment, fewer opportunities exist for incidental activity, creating many contexts of daily life that are conducive to prolonged sitting. So how do we counter the effect of sitting too much? To find out, the research team recruited 24 adults, ages 35 to 70, both male and female, who had had type 2 diabetes for more than 3 months and who were considered to be inactive, That is, they sat for more than 5 hours a day and were not meeting recommended exercise guidelines. As far as the researchers were able to determine, this was the first study to analyze prolonged sitting and exercise periods in people with type 2 diabetes. Each of the participants completed 3 experimental conditions, each lasting 8 hours. In the first of the conditions, the subjects sat for 8 hours without taking any exercise breaks. To achieve an absolute minimum of activity, they were taken on their bathroom breaks in a wheelchair. In the second, the subjects took breaks every half hour, during which they did exercises, squats, leg lifts, and calf raises for 3 minutes. In the third condition, they took 6-minute exercise breaks once every hour. While experiencing the conditions and doing the exercises, the participants had various physical measurements evaluated, such as blood pressure, blood flow, and the diameter of the femoral artery, which supplies blood to the legs and feet. The researchers determined that, compared to constant sitting, both exercise conditions resulted in improved blood vessel function. However, the improvement was significantly greater in the second condition, in which the exercise periods were shorter but more frequent. It appears, therefore, that how often a person with type 2 diabetes exercises is more important for blood vessel health than how long the exercise lasts. As the researchers wrote, because blood vessel function deteriorates as type 2 diabetes progresses, it's possible that more frequent interruptions to sitting are needed to preserve blood flow to the legs. Our findings suggest that more frequent and shorter breaks may be more beneficial than longer, less frequent breaks for improvement in vascular function. They also said a high-frequency break strategy may be suitable in sedentary workplaces. Feeding Your Habit by Robert S. Dinsmore. Do you know people who do some type of workout every day, whether it's walking, jogging, biking, weightlifting, or something different? Do you ever wonder where they get the sheer willpower to force themselves to do it day in and day out? I'll let you in on a little secret. It's not just willpower, it's habit. Willpower really comes into play when you're trying to form a habit, especially if you haven't been active for a while. The hardest thing to do may be overcoming inertia, getting off the couch and moving. Once you've chosen an activity such as walking, it's worth doing everything you can to reinforce that habit. Here are some tips for habit forming. How to form a habit. Try to do it every day or at least several times a week. If you let your exercise habit lapse, you'll be back where you started, and you may have a hard time picking it up again. Having once experienced a 2-year exercise slump, I had a very hard time pulling myself out of. I'm very wary of getting out of the habit again. Schedule a time of day when you'll exercise regularly. Many hard-working folks do their walking, jogging, or biking right before or right after work. If you wind up exercising outdoors at night, be sure to wear visible clothing like a reflective coat or vest, or even a blinking light. Have fun. Somewhere along the way, many people lose sight of a simple fact. We tend to keep doing things that are rewarding to us, that we enjoy. While some of us actually look forward to exercise as a way to de-stress, it never hurts to find extra rewards. If you love the outdoors, consider exercising in the woods, in a park, or on the beach. If you need a social fix, exercise with close friends or join a virtual or outdoor group exercise class, such as Zumba, kickboxing, aerobics, spinning, or yoga. Exercising with friends or joining an exercise class can keep you on a regular exercise schedule. If you almost never get a chance to listen to your new wave or heavy metal music, you can use earbuds and listen while you're working out. Mix it up. Vary your activities as much as possible, such as biking one day, doing a group aerobics class the next, hiking the next, and so on. If you walk, jog, run, or bike, find different routes, so you'll be constantly having a change of scenery. When I walk or ride my bike, I often intentionally get myself a little bit lost so that I discover places I've never been, but I wouldn't recommend it for hiking. Keeping your workouts fresh often requires a little bit of creative thinking, but it's well worth it. Keep on keeping on. Cool New Products to Try by Amy Campbell. Copper Compression Copper Arch Supports. Flat feet, heel spurs, hammer toes, plantar fasciitis. These common foot ailments cause pain and discomfort and can impact your quality of life. Copper compression copper arch supports can help. These supports are made from 85% copper-infused nylon. Slip these bands on your feet to lift your arches, reduce muscle strain, and redistribute pressure across your feet. They're recommended for many foot problems, including fallen arches, arthritis, and bunions. Give your tired, achy feet some much-needed relief. They'll thank you for it. CopperCompression.com. WW Scale by Conair. Did you set a summer goal to eat better, get in shape, and maybe lose a few pounds? If so, you now have a way to easily and inexpensively track your progress. The WW Scale by Conair is so much more than your run-of-the-mill bathroom scale. Along with measuring your weight, it can estimate your BMI, body mass index, body fat, body water, and bone mass. And the scale's memory tracks these metrics for up to four users. It holds up to 400 pounds and is made of safety-tempered glass. Now you can get a comprehensive picture of how all of your hard work is paying off from just one scale. Conair.com. Grill Armor Extreme Heat Resistance Oven Gloves. 'Tis the season for grilling. Regular pot holders don't always hold up, making it easy to drop dishes and burn yourself. The Grill Armor Extreme Heat Resistant Oven Gloves are heat-resistant up to 932 degrees Fahrenheit, providing you with the ultimate in heat protection whether you're working the barbecue, baking, or cooking. They're super comfy and lightweight, but they're strong and durable, too. The glove's silicone super grip surface prevents slipping, and the five-finger design gives you flexibility and easier grasping of your dishes, pans, and grilling tools. Perfect for campfires and fire pits, too. GrillArmorGloves.com. This is Barbara Foster.